Hello everyone, this is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor at Cedar Ridge and want to welcome you this morning. Thank you so much for being here and joining us for what is our second virtual service. I don't think any of us imagined we'd be meeting like this even just a few weeks ago, but here we are in these difficult circumstances. And again, thank you so much for being here. I think it's fair to say we're all struggling right now. These are not easy times. I know I certainly am. I think having our movements and activities restricted is somewhat stressful. We're afraid, you know, both for ourselves, for those close and near to us, as well as those we care about who are far off. You know, this is a worldwide pandemic, so a lot of fear and anxiety. And I think we're all having to find a new normal, and that can be difficult. We're being pushed out of our comfort zones with life being so different now. And I know I'm personally struggling with that. I would much rather meet with people in person than by phone call or conference call. I don't feel all that comfortable sometimes with technology. I know that's going to be a real surprise to you to hear that. But even speaking right now into a computer rather than with all of you in front of me, it just feels so different. But you know, that can find out our insecurities. I'm certainly reflecting on that myself, and you know, how I find my identity and what I do and how well I do it rather than in just who I am. And not worry so much about how I might perform. So there's opportunity for growth, I think, in these trials, in these difficulties. And none of us would wish this on ourselves or on anybody else. But the circumstances are what they are. So I want to encourage us all to lean into the growth opportunities that we have and the ways that we can perhaps see ourselves in a new light and grow as a result. We're in a series at the moment for Lent. It's the fourth Sunday of Lent that really is getting at all those kind of issues, those growth issues. We're calling the series Inside Out and Upside Down. It's there's some material accompanying the series here. It's based on the Sermon on the Mount, which is the sermon that Jesus gave in Matthew's Gospel, chapters 5 to 7. And the material includes all kinds of discussion questions and reflections and some prayer practices that help lead us into the practice of stillness, which is one of our themes for Lent. And I want to encourage you to check those out. The message today is going to focus in on what's become known as the Lord's Prayer. And the questions will help us unpack that a little bit more. I'll share some things today, but I think the questions will really help you work out how you interpret this. And the reflections and prayer exercises help us just to dig a little deeper and apply it into our own lives. So download a copy of those online if you don't have a copy already. Today, we're going to look at that section that we just heard read to us. It begins in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1. And Jesus, in that passage, as you just heard, addresses three religious practices, three spiritual practices that are quite common to all religions, and that's almsgiving, prayer, and fasting. As I mentioned, we're going to focus in on prayer, but with all three of these, Jesus is challenging the prevailing way. He's offering us a different way of looking at those spiritual practices. And he contrasts his way with the religious way of the day. He challenges both the Jewish faith and the pagan faiths. I think it's interesting that in this section he challenges both, because I think sometimes Jesus is seen as always challenging Judaism. Jesus was Jewish, and when Jesus challenges Judaism, I think all he's doing is challenging religion in general. I don't think we should interpret that in any kind of anti-Semitic way at all. And so, you know, but I think we also need to be very sensitive when we do the same thing. That we don't come across or even intentionally are anti-Jewish. I think Jesus is just simply criticizing and challenging religion as a whole. And if he was present in the same way today, Within our Christian context, I expect Jesus would be very much challenging and critiquing Christianity. So it's much more generic than specific, I think, Jesus's challenge. And as I said, in the passage today, he's particularly when it comes to prayer, he's challenging the prevailing pagan ways as well as the prevailing Jewish ways. But Jesus is saying, it's not, he's challenging religion, but he's saying the reason for that is because of religion often leads us to ostentation. We do these practices to impress God or to impress other people. Whereas Jesus is saying these things should be hidden. And that's because spirituality is formed on the inside. That's a theme of what we've been seeing in Jesus's teaching in this section. Jesus is talking about a hidden way, a secret way, if you like. He even uses that language. It's change that happens from the inside out. And he uses this term of your reward shall be in heaven. And we could interpret that, of course, that Jesus is saying, do the right thing here in this life and you'll be rewarded in an afterlife. But I think what Jesus is getting at here is saying that his way, the kingdom of heaven, which can be experienced here and now, is a rewarding way to live. It's a meaningful way to live. For instance, with almsgiving, for example, we could see almsgiving or helping the poor as a way to placate God, or a way to impress other people with our generosity. And Jesus is certainly challenging people who do that. But another way, the Jesus way of looking at almsgiving or helping the poor, is that we are recipients already of God's incredible love. And as recipients of that love, we have compassion and empathy for other people. We don't look down on other people, but see ourselves as connected to other people. And we reach out with generosity towards them. That's a very different way of approaching almsgiving. It's the way that Jesus is offering to us and inviting us into. So as I've mentioned, we're going to look, even though Jesus addresses three spiritual practices, he majors on one, which is prayer. And we're going to look at that in more detail. And in particular, we're going to look at this prayer that Jesus teaches us, which has become known as the Lord's Prayer. And let's just look at that now. It's quite famous, and some of the language here will probably feel quite familiar to us, but we're going to sort of look at it with fresh eyes, as we often try to do. It says, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." Jesus prefaces that prayer with the statement, "This then is how you should pray." In other words, I think Jesus is showing us a general way to pray. He's showing us a template, if you like, for prayer. And in fact, if you look at Luke's gospel, where this prayer occurs in Luke's gospel, it's a response to a request of the disciples to teach us how to pray. So this is Jesus showing us the way in prayer, laying down a pattern of prayer, if you like. And what I want to do is look at some of those patterns, and want to particularly look at four aspects of this prayer, or, you know, in answer to the question, what is prayer like, four types of prayer that Jesus is showing us here. The first one is that it's prayer is simple. Prayer is accessible. Prayer draws us into communion with God, and then prayer draws us into communion with one another. So four aspects to prayer that Jesus seems to be laying down for us here. So let's just go through those. Firstly, prayer is simple. So I think one of the striking things about this prayer is that it's not that long. It's quite simple, and that was not normal for prayers of those days. Jesus in the passage references pagans who babble on and are almost incomprehensibly long in their prayers, but the Jewish tradition of prayer at that time was that you would pray three times a day, or up to three times a day, with quite long formal prayers that had up to 18 benedictions and petitions in them. And were quite complex, and Jesus is just completely breezing past that really by giving us a very, very simple prayer. What I find fascinating actually is that in most of our traditions, including our tradition at Cedar Ridge, the Lord's Prayer, when we recite it, has an ending that you'll have noticed didn't appear in the passage we just read. And that's the part that ends, "For yours is the power, for yours is the kingdom, the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen." So what Jesus is, what the original writers seem to do here, whoever wrote Matthew's gospel did not include that part. The early manuscripts are much simpler and end with what we just heard read to us. But as the manuscripts were copied and as they were further transcribed, the early followers of Jesus seemed to think that Jesus was oversimplifying things, and they added in this ending. In other words, they wanted to make it a little bit fancier, a little bit more complex. But what we have in the original is, again, very, very simple. And I mentioned earlier that this prayer also appears in Luke's gospel. And in fact, in Luke's gospel, it's even simpler. So prayer, in Jesus's view, is very simple. Prayer is also accessible in Jesus's view. So let's look again at the prayer. It begins with the first line, "Our Father in heaven." And that's a very accessible statement. It might be a little lost on us because we're so familiar with it now. But really what it does here is it universalizes communion with God. In other words, this is not a prayer to a very specific God who has to be addressed a certain way. So for instance, in the Hebrew tradition, this was the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. There's no language is used like that. It's just "Our Father." It's a direct address to God. It's very accessible. And it's prayer in the vernacular language, in the colloquial language. Scholars are pretty much universally agreed that when Jesus prayed this prayer, and in fact, when Jesus gives the whole of the Sermon on the Mount, it's all in Aramaic. And there's no indication that Jesus changes when he prays to speak in Hebrew, which was the way that the Jewish tradition, in the Jewish tradition, you had to pray. You had to pray in Hebrew. That was the sacred language. Jesus is continuing on in the same vernacular. He's using his native Aramaic tongue to pray. And that's again quite revolutionary. And Jesus is saying that there is no sacred language, or perhaps more, he's saying all language is sacred, every language is sacred, and we can access prayer, we can access God just as we are in our own culture. And importantly here, that means that when Jesus says "Our Father," he would have used the term "Abba," which is the Aramaic for father. And this word was one of his favorite words. It's a very important word to Jesus, one of his favorite terms for God, one of his favorite metaphors for God, such that it became really precious and important to the early Christian community. They retained this Aramaic word, even though for much of the early Christian community, Aramaic wasn't necessarily their native tongue. They used Greek, for instance, for their writings, and we see this term "Abba" though retained in the Greek writings of the Christian scriptures three times, in Mark's gospel and in Paul's writings, in his letter to the Romans and to the Galatians. And the term "Abba" is included. But it's always followed with the Greek term for father. So it's "Abba ho pater." In other words, "Abba, Father." The Greek-speaking world needed that word to be translated for them because they weren't Aramaic speakers. But the native language was retained. The Aramaic language was retained because that word itself was so important to Jesus and so important to the early Christian community. And that word is such a beautiful word because it has connotations of intimacy and familiarity. It was a word that children would use to address their father, perhaps best translated "dad" or "daddy." So there's something very accessible and intimate about it. But it also retains this connotation of respect. It was how a teacher might be addressed as well. So it's got this combination of intimacy and respect that Jesus captures in the term "Abba." and uses to address God. And again, that's so unlike the religions of the day. The pagan religions, for instance, when they would address dignitaries, when they would address their gods, when they would address Caesar, would have sometimes hundreds of names that they would use. We have inscriptions to Roman inscriptions to Caesar that begin with an unending list of names and attributes for Caesar before they even begin the address proper. In the Hebrew scriptures, God is never directly addressed as Father. So this is a novel idea, a novel teaching of Jesus's. And I think we need to remember that when Jesus uses this term Father, Jesus is moving the connotation of God, or the way we view God, away from authoritarian or patriarchal contexts. In other words, I don't think Jesus is saying God is male. I don't think Jesus is saying God is authoritarian. In fact, Jesus redefines, if you like, fatherhood, or defines divine fatherhood for us in many, many of the stories that he told, especially the one in Luke 15 about the prodigal son returning to the compassionate, loving father. This isn't a metaphor that indicates masculinity or authoritarianism, quite the opposite. And we just need to remember that because, you know, there's no perfect metaphor, and language is always limiting for us. So prayer is simple, based on this prayer of Jesus. Prayer is accessible. And then thirdly, prayer makes us aware of our communion with God. I think, you know, well, let's look at the words here again. We began with our Father in heaven. And then it follows on, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So these three statements, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, and your will be done, they all invoke the flow of God's love to earth. They're all, let your love come, O God, if you like. They're not requests for necessarily our own interests to be met. You know, I think what's surprising here in this prayer is actually how few petitions there are. This isn't a prayer that has lots of, God, please do this for me, please sort that situation out, please do this, that, and the other. This is an acknowledgement and a recognition that God's love is flowing into the world, and it's a submission to that, or a surrender to it. That phrase, hallowed be your name, could also be translated, make your name holy. And that phrase echoes the sentiments of the prophets, the ancient Hebrew prophets, who would cry out to God to make God's name holy in the earth. And the way that God did that was through redeeming acts, through acts of mercy, through reconciliation and healing, both nationally and internationally, and also individually. So God's name is made holy through God's love being manifest in the earth. And so this is a request, really, for God's love to be made known in the earth, in the all of the world. Your kingdom come, your will be done. This is Jesus's way of the kingdom, God's love, again, being manifest on the earth. And the term there, on earth as it is in heaven, I think just indicates to us some tension that God's will and way isn't always being done. So this prayer is actually a submission, a surrender to a consciousness of the fact that there's that tension. And we're wanting to enter into that tension, and we're saying, may love come, may God's way prevail. We're putting ourselves in that, we're aligning ourselves with it. And I think that implies conscious cooperation with it, that this prayer is saying, it's not about my way. It's not about me getting my desires met or my will done. This is, there's something far greater at work here, and prayer connects us to that greater work. It's interesting, I think, that in one of those passages I mentioned earlier where the word Abba is retained, is in Mark's Gospel, chapter 14, and it's where Jesus prays, just before he goes to his death, he prays, Abba, Father, let not this cup pass. He doesn't want to go to his death, but then he says, "Don't not my will, but yours be done." And so there's this connection between surrender to the way of God and alignment with the divine way, and connection to the intimacy with God. There's the sense of Abba and intimacy is directly connected to our alignment with the will and way of God. So it's simple prayer in Jesus' way. It's accessible, and it makes us aware of our communion with God. Fourthly, finally, it makes us aware of our communion with all of humanity. Let's look at the second half of this prayer. Again, this language is very familiar to us, but perhaps we can see it in fresh light. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Now, these sound a little bit more like petitions or requests. But there's nothing selfish about these when we look at them. Firstly, there's we language everywhere. It's not about I or me. It's about our Father, and it's about your will being done on earth. It's the whole earth. And again, this is somewhat unique because many of the religious prayers of the day had very ethnocentric elements to them. There would be prayers about blessing my nation, my city even, my family. And even prayers against enemy states and enemy cultures. But this is not like that. This is a prayer for the whole earth. There's an awareness here of our shared human need. When we pray, give us this day our daily bread, we're praying for bread, which was a staple in the Middle Eastern diet. We're not praying for luxuries here. We're praying for just basic human needs, but we're also praying for our bread. We're not praying just for my bread, but we're acknowledging that we all have needs. And as we think about God's love, as we've just acknowledged in the first part of the prayer, God's love flowing into the world, we're acknowledging that that's not just about me, that's about everyone. I need to receive that and share it. And share myself, share my resources. I can't pray for my needs without also seeing those needs in the context of everybody else. We see a similar sentiment in the next phrase, which is forgive us our debts, or forgive us our sins as we forgive our debtors. Different translations do use different language there. And Jesus picks this this issue out much more starkly right after the prayer, where he says, if you don't forgive other people, God can't forgive you. And that might sound a bit harsh, might sound a bit confusing. Well, how come God can't forgive? Can't God always forgive? I think what Jesus is simply getting at here is that we're just as we're intimately connected to God, we're intimately connected to one another. And we're either flowing in the way of God, the way of love, or we're not. We can't pick and choose. So if we're not forgiving other people, then we're not going to be able to receive forgiveness. We can't receive what we can't give away. Just as in at the same time, we can't give away what we can't receive. So there's a cycle to this. There's a rhythm to this, and that's the natural order of things. And likewise, we can live in resentment and retain hatred and anger and unforgiveness in our hearts, and that makes it impossible for us to receive forgiveness. So again, this is a prayer that acknowledges our deep connection to one another, as well as our deep intimacy and connection to God. Finally, it says, it ends with, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And that again is perhaps a somewhat confusing term. Like, does God really lead people into temptation? That would seem a little bit deceptive on God's part. But one way of translating the term temptation there is trial or testing. And in fact, in some traditions around the world, when this prayer is recited, they use the term keep us in the time of trial. And the sense here is that difficult circumstances happen. I think we're acutely aware of that right now, right? Things happen, and we just heard, we just prayed earlier, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, implying that God's will isn't always being done. In other words, there's tension there, and we are entering into that tension. things don't always work out the way they should. And so we're this part of the prayer is asking for help to prevail in the time of trial, support in the time of trial, support in the time of difficulty. But again, it's keep us in the time of trial. It's deliver us from evil. It's corporate language. It's collective language. And I think the implication here is that we need to make good choices for ourselves in difficult circumstances, but also choices that bear other people's welfare in mind as well. This isn't just about us. This is about collective safety and collective well-being. So I think in all of this, what we're seeing in the first part of the prayer is the fact that we're connected to God, and it brings us into a greater awareness, a greater consciousness of our connection to God and our the opportunity to partner with God and align with God's will and way in the earth, but also our intimate and deep connection to one another. This makes us much more aware consciously of each other and the fact that we belong to one another, that we need each other and other people need us. So to close out here, I think perhaps we could summarize this prayer, and I'm reticent to do that because this is such a profound prayer, but just for the sake of moving forward with it, I think we could summarize this prayer with the fact that prayer challenges us to personal responsibility. Again, this isn't so much about getting stuff from God. This isn't about praying to some being in the sky who has a magic wand and can get stuff done for us. This is much more profound than that. It challenges us to personal responsibility. So we're responsible for certain things, and prayer connects us to that responsibility. Firstly, it connects us to engagement and empowerment with divine presence. In other words, we say our Father, we come to our Father. Jesus doesn't say how often to do that, but the implication is that we have a responsibility to do that. We have a responsibility to connect with God, who is always present to us. I mentioned earlier about our material accompanying this series, and that has lots of prayers and exercises that can help us do that. So let's take responsibility. Let's take advantage of those things. Secondly, it shows us our responsibility for partnership with God in renewing the earth, renewing the world. Not only do we connect, but we also are empowered by that presence. And that presence is one that aligns us with a way that's higher than ours, that is bigger than ours. And then thirdly, it reminds us of our responsibility and challenges us to our responsibility and commitment to the needs of others. So as we come to God and connect, as we align with the will and way of God, and as we flow in the way of God, we see other people in a different light. We have more compassion and empathy, and we cooperate with God in helping one another and meeting the needs of each other. Prayer is a lot more than trying to get God to do things for us. And the 19th century Danish theologian and philosopher Kierkegaard said this well, I think, although he uses some non-gender inclusive language, but he says, prayer does not change God, but it changes him who prays. Perhaps we could better put that, prayer does not change God, but it changes all who pray. We don't come to God to get stuff done necessarily so much as for us to surrender to a different way, for us to be changed and transformed. And that's good news, because I think we're, if you're anything like me, you know that you need to change. I know that I need to change, and we need change in our world. We need more of God's will and way in the world, and we are cooperating with that through prayer. So let's come to communion now. We're going to take communion together, and together might mean that you have people with you right now in your home, and you can share the bread and wine or whatever it is you're taking. We could use bread and wine or crackers and juice or milk and cookies, whatever it is you're taking, we can do it together. But you might also be on your own right now, and that's the case for many of us, unusually so at the moment. But we're also together because we're all doing this right now. We're all doing it together. So whatever situation you're in, as we do this, let's remember a couple of things. Firstly, the communion reminds us of our communion with God, our connection to God, that God is accessible. I love the Quaker tradition that actually doesn't practice communion as a ritual, but says that communion is every meal that we eat, because God is present everywhere, all the time. But we can especially remember that right now, that God, the bread and the wine reminds us that God is all around us. God is present to us right now. We have access, and that's a very precious thing. It's also a reminder that we are in communion with one another, that we belong to one another, that we're precious to one another, and that we can build bridges across the divides that there are in the world. And we see many of those divides coming down right now, I think, as we have a shared vulnerability as human beings. So let's remember those two things, and treasure those two things as we take the bread and wine, as we celebrate communion together. Let's remember that God is with us and we belong to each other. Thanks so much again for joining us. Celebrate communion with heart and soul. And may God be with you. Thank you.